Righty, I've actually got 7:30. So if everyone's comfortable, we might start, bearing in mind that we've only got an hour and hopefully we can get through everything that we need to get through. So if I can just ask everyone to mute their phone until they actually want to speak, that would be great. That would be fantastic because that'll cut down on the background noise. And for those of you that I haven't met and who don't know me, my name is Deb Lee and I'm the CEO of the Adelaide PHN. And joining us online tonight are Janet Quigley and Helen Pope, and also Alex Nickery from the department, who have got the list of questions that have been sent in. And thank you to everyone that's a question in. Welcome. So we've got a lot to get through. Obviously, we want to get through as much as possible. And as I said, thank you that you sent in earlier. So we'll start with those. I'll just set the scene a little bit, but we'll start with those. And we'll pause after each question. If people have got further questions or clarification that they need to ask, then it's probably the best time to go for it then. Obviously, it's a little bit difficult via teleconference because we can't see you. So if you could just state your name and your practice so that we know where you're from when Janet and Helen, Alex or myself answer the question, that will give us a clue as to who we're talking to. Just want to let everyone know that we're actually recording the session as well. That's not in any way meant to be devious. It's just so that we can actually put it up on our website with the questions and the answers in the next few days. So the APHN on its website will have a landing button up in the next few days, and all of the available healthcare home resources will be put on there, including the recording of this teleconference with the questions and answers, and there'll also be a fact sheet that we'll put out as well in collaboration with the department, obviously, in terms of those answers to those questions. All right. So, Janet, I think we are now up to the questions. So each of you would have received the submitted questions for the Q&A sessions. We can start with those, Janet, if you're comfortable.
Yep, that sounds good. Okay, so we've grouped, we're doing these by theme. So I'll start with the training questions. With the first one was, what is the duration of the training and who should attend? So training for practices, we haven't got a defined period. Because the amount of time practices will take to complete the training will depend on your starting point, your needs as a practice, and time that you're willing and able to spend working through the modules to embed the lessons within the practice. So reading through the training modules can be done relatively quickly, but we've drawn a lot from the experience models overseas, which suggests that the transformation process for practices can take a significant amount of time. We appreciate that. The training is based on a train-the-trainer approach, which will have two PHN facilitators trained in August. Then they work very closely with the practice managers within the practice. And it's based on 11 modules, which you will have seen in the handbook. As part of the training package, practices will undertake a self-assessment. We have got a tool that the PHNs can use, but if the practices already use their own tool, then that's okay too. But that will allow you to assess your current capabilities and target your training accordingly. And then, as I say, the PHN practice facilitators will be able to assist in using the self-assessment tool that's recommended in the training guidelines if you don't already use one. So all members of the practice should understand the healthcare home concept. As you can appreciate, the healthcare home model is very much about a team-based practice approach. And so the intention is that all members of the practice can contribute to that transformation. But again, it's a self-assessment within the practice to determine what's already been applied in your practice and what other elements of the training that you'd need to take on. We've also said there's also a question around monitoring a budget or any budget related training modules for the practice. Due to the diverse number of business structures that exist in the primary healthcare system, we don't have a specific budget module, but we can certainly think about that as far as feedback from PHNs and practices go. We do have the Australian Association of Practice Managers who've done a number of sessions for us in relation to considerations, particularly around the budgeting and funding model. And they're also going to develop a framework for how you capture the services that are being delivered under the bundled payment, and that may also assist in thinking about the budget element of the bundled payment. So that work is happening alongside the training modules, but it isn't a particular module as yet. I might pause there because I've just got the two questions on training to see if there's any questions or clarification people might need on that. Okay. Risk stratification tool. So I've got three questions related to the tool. What are the costs or the risk for the risk stratification tool, both one-off and running? Who pays for it? So all the costs associated with the risk stratification tool for stage one are covered by the Department of Health. This includes software licenses for participating practices and PHNs. How does the data have to be coded to work optimally and accurately? So providers should appropriately code the information in their GP clinical software. So, for example, if the use of the features of the software rather than free text, ensuring that patient data, including diagnosis, prescriptions and measurements or test results, are accurate and current. And page 12 in your handbook goes into a bit more detail around that. But clearly when we're using the risk stratification tool, the more accurate your data is in your GP software, the more it will be able to fit within the risk stratification tool. Can we have access to the risk stratification tool now, and when will it be available? So it's currently being developed. Precedence Healthcare and CSIRO are responsible for calibrating and validating the predictive risk model. So the risk tool software is scheduled for installation and training in September 2017 this year. Practices wishing to investigate in the interim may be able to undertake some indicative modelling using a sample of their own data and the Q admissions predictive risk model and the HARP questionnaire. And there's a fact sheet on our website called the Patient Identification Fact Sheet, and it has all the links to those models and questionnaire that you'll be able to look at and go through in detail. And that's what is being used to inform the development of the risk stratification tool. I'll just stop there and see if there's any questions.
Hello, can you hear me? This is Dr. Raphael Ng, Akbar Medical Center.
Yes.
Yeah, so just a question about the software licensing. So you said during the trial period it will be paid for by the Department of Health. Is there a time period? Because the obviously certain software licenses, they have running costs and it's annual. So I'm just wondering, is there an estimate of how long the running costs will be? So of how much the running costs could be?
Yep. Renee, did you want to take that one?
Sure. So the Commonwealth will cover the costs of practices using the risk stratification software throughout the trial period. So that will include a period before service delivery commences. So as Janet's mentioned, that for the practices starting on 1 October, the practices will have access to that risk stratification tool software from September. And then for the practices starting on 1 December, similarly, they'll have the software available before 1 December. And then we'll cover the costs throughout the trial period, so right up to the end of clinical service delivery finishing in 2 years' time.
Okay, so that's the end. And if, let's say, at the end of the trial period, the decision is not to continue, then we do not have to repay any of those costs.
No, that wouldn't be the case. I guess, you know, you've kind of reflected that there's a decision that needs to be made by government about whether, you know, the trial was to continue or expand. And at that point, we'd have to look at the costs of the software going forward. But certainly, practices are covered for the entire trial period. And if the trial doesn't, if there's no continuation or expansion, there'd be no expectation for any of the costs that we've covered during the trial period to be repaid, no.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I'll keep going. The next theme is the shared care planning approach. The question is, will there be any license costs or other fees for the use of the shared care planning tool? So the costs of the shared care planning tools are not covered separately by the department and need to be supported from the grant that we would be paying to practices. So we're giving $10,000 to each of the participating practices, and that can be used for a variety of establishment costs. So if you're changing to a different shared care planning tool, you could use that $10,000 to support that. In some instances, we do know that PHNs have been purchasing licences for their regions, so, and that's a decision for PHNs, so that also may be an option. Do we have to use those listed software providers, or can we use current software? So practices can use any software program that meets the minimum requirements listed on the department's website. This was something that we did deliberately so that we could get software vendors to respond to where the healthcare home was going and do some of their own development. And we had met with various software vendors late last year, and they were all very interested in ensuring that their software would meet the minimum requirements. So there is a self-declaration process in meeting those minimum requirements, and they're listed on the MSIA's website, which is the peak body for software vendors. We would expect more and more of the vendors to be meeting those requirements in the lead up to the start date, and they're the companies or program or vendors that you should be looking to use if you're looking to change your software. And there was also a question on, has a decision been made on which shared care planning tool will be used in the Adelaide PHN region? So this is a decision for practices. And Deb, I'm not sure whether you had anything to add from the PHN's perspective on a regional solution.
Sure do. Thanks, Janet. So what we're actually doing is we have made provision in our forward budgets for shared care planning software for practices who are part of the healthcare homes trial. So we'd be really keen moving forward to talk to you about what your preferred platform would be. And we certainly have done a lot of research into what's out there and what would be the most useful platform to consider. So moving forward, what we would be looking at doing is that once the agreements contracts are back to the department and they've been executed, that we would get our healthcare home practices in for a face-to-face meeting to actually go through some of this and keep you up to date with where we're at and find out what it is that you think would be the primary platform that you would prefer to use and where we're at in terms of negotiating with various vendors around that.
Any questions on the shared care planning? Okay, moving on to the assessment tool. There is a question around when the practice assessment tool will become available. So it will become available to PHNs in advance of their training workshops in mid-August this year. And when will the assurance self-assessment tool be ready? Is this the same as the practice assessment tool? So the department's continuing to work on documents that will assist the healthcare home in building a compliance culture, such as an annual assurance self-assessment tool. So that's what the assurance, so there is a distinction between the assurance self-assessment tool and the practice assessment tool. So the assurance self-assessment tool is around compliance activities. The compliance toolkit, which will be coming to you as soon as it's finalised, has got a range of, it's a toolkit that provides practices with a range of initiatives to help with that sort of compliance culture in your practice. Compliance has got a very strong education and training focus, particularly in stage one. We recognise that this is a very new model, and so if there are things that are being picked up as not being quite in line with the model, our first approach would be to come in, talk to the practices, see what's going on, make sure that everybody knows what the expectations are, and to provide any assistance in meeting those, and that's what the self-assurance, self-assessment tool is related to. And that tool will be made available as soon as it's finalised. Any questions there? Okay, moving on to data collection. Question was, we have to provide information to the department as evidence of compliance, what type of information is required. So practices will need to keep accurate records of healthcare home services provided to an enrolled patient in the patient's clinical record. The handbook identifies the record keeping requirements for healthcare homes. So for example, on page 13 of the handbook, it identifies the documents that must be retained and uploaded to the patient's clinical record for each of the registered practices. Data-driven improvement details are provided in the training modules. What data will the department be requiring to be collected and forwarded? So in earlier discussions, we've had discussions with the PHNs around their ability to support the data work for the healthcare home evaluation. So we've had confirmation from all of our 10 PHNs that they'll be able to support the data that's required from GP practices. So there's what's required is de-identified unit record level data, which we understand that 10 CS is able to release subject to agreement of the practice and appropriate ethics approval. We also need data for the whole healthcare home practice, so not just the healthcare home patients within the practice. Data from a similar number of non-healthcare home practices, which we're looking to collect, which will provide a comparison group so that we can see the difference between the healthcare home patients in stage one and the non-healthcare home patients. Data will need to be identify which patients are enrolled in the healthcare home, and we propose to do this by establishing a consistent method for coding healthcare home patients within the clinical software and then requiring practices to follow this method. That's all going to be incorporated into the training materials that are being developed by the department and which will start to flow from August. How will practices provide healthcare home stage one related data to the PHNs or Department of Health? So practices who currently provide data to their PHN will continue in their as is with their current practice. And so the department is exploring how the PHNs will provide the data based on the PHN's confirmation to support this aspect of the evaluation to the department, noting that the de-identified data will be placed in the department's secure enterprise data warehouse, the EDW, and that's where our health policy analysis contractor will be able to access the data. For those GP practices that are currently using other data sharing mechanisms, and an example is the NPS MedicineWise, the department can also consider whether that is a way for us to extract that data from general practice. So we're still working through some of those issues, but our first point of call will be the PHNs, who we know have got established relationships with some of the practices within healthcare homes and may also be the appropriate entity to manage the whole 20 if that can be negotiated with the GP practices. Any questions on data?
Is Maria here from the representing the Health Hub and the Aboriginal Family Clinic?
Yes.
Because we are also collecting data for the Closing the Gap grant-funded programs for Aboriginal health, would there be any conflict about reporting same data?
No, I think it's more what we're trying to do is not have to duplicate, and we're very aware that some of the Aboriginal medical services do provide a significant amount of data already for a range of purposes. Mm-hmm. If we can use that data, so collect once and use many times, that's clearly ideal. That often relates, though, to ethics approvals on the use of that data. So we'll need to look at the AMSs closely, I think, to see how we might be able to use those existing collections within the bounds that they're being collected. And we'll get back to you on more detail on that. The evaluation framework is still being finalised, and a lot of the data elements of the evaluation are still being worked through at the moment, and things like the what's already being collected and how might it be used for the purposes of our evaluation are still being finalised.
Thank you, because the Aboriginal ethics, of course, would have, you know, the data collection of Aboriginal data would be a more stricter, I think,
yes,
to go through a different,
yes, absolutely,
committee. Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on to some clinical questions. How do we determine if a presentation is related or not related to a chronic condition so that we can access the fee-for-service MBS items? So this is quite a common question, and because each patient is going to be quite unique depending on their disease and their complexity, we've deliberately steered away from trying to define what might be a non-chronic condition or a non-chronic activity that can be billed against the MBS. So, but I guess one thing that we have intended with the bundled payment is the majority of the care should be able to be provided by the bundled payment if we've got the value right, and this is something we will be validating in stage one. So your MBS fee for service items should be quite small, so that gives you one, I guess, indicator. One thing that we have used, for example, is a pap smear. That's clearly is generally a standalone item that women are expected to have as a screening measure. That would be an MBS fee-for-service item. But as far as being able to dictate what would and wouldn't fit under a chronic disease condition is clearly very hard for us to do, because it will be such an individual decision. Noting, though, I guess, that the bundled payment is meant to cover most of the care. Who is responsible to identifying the significant change in health that increases or decreases the complexity of their healthcare needs? So practices are responsible for the correct registration of enrolled patients on the DHS HPOS system and any updates. So when we've got the risk stratification tool, that there will be two steps to the risk stratification tool. One is the Q-admissions tool that you will run through at a practice level, drawing on data from your GP software systems. That will give you the patients that are in scope for the healthcare home model. From there, you can then select the patients that you believe would be appropriate for stage one. You would bring them into the clinic and you would run the HARP questionnaire, which has both a range of clinical and social questions. So the clinical questions will be drawn from your GP software and will be, I think, pre-populated from the queue admissions process, the first step that you run through. And then you've got questions around the social elements, which could be, do they have a carer? And Renee is probably able to talk to this in a bit more detail. Those questions will have a level of subjectivity and will be based on the clinician's view. And those social questions may raise the level of mishearing for the patient, depending on the view of the clinician. If there's an incorrect stratification of the enrolled patients, there's an opportunity for you to review that halfway through the year. So all your patients are required to be reviewed and assessed to make sure that you think they're in the right tier. And then this is a part of the compliance activity where we will also be making sure that that risk stratification tool, one, is doing what it's intended to do and stratifying patients appropriately. And then from the practice's view, are they also being stratified and moving up and down the tiers as a product of it? Renee, did you want to add anything to that one?
Dan, I think that that's a good overview, and perhaps I'm happy to wait if there are any more detailed questions.
Okay, great. And then who completes the risk tier questionnaire? And is there a Medicare rebate associated with this? So as we touched on, the HARP questionnaire will be auto-completed from a patient's medical record if the data is available. However, this is the non-clinical factor that may not be in the patient's medical record that needs to be collected, and this is where some of the subjectivity is applied. These should be assessed by a clinician in consultation with the patient, as this process requires patient consent. And on page 13 of your handbook, there's some detail around the enrolment process. There's no specific rebate associated with the patient assessment, but that's likely to occur before you have activated them as a healthcare home patient. So it would likely fit within a standard consultation, and so you'd have the MBS rebate that could be applied to that particular consultation. I'll stop there and see if there's any questions.
Hi, Dr. Raphael Ng from the Akaba Medical Center again. Just with regard to the risk stratification, just the question whether there'll be any penalties or payback that wasn't really answered. Could you elaborate if there'll be any penalties or payback that is required on the practices part if they were stratified higher than what they actually are at the review?
Renee, did you want to take that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so I guess my response to that would be that, as Janet said, part of stage one is about, testing the use of the risk stratification tool and ensuring that it is doing what it's intended to do. It's definitely an area of interest for us in terms of collecting information on patients and their tiers. And it's true that it is an area of interest for the assurance part of our program. So we're definitely interested in, the types of patients and how they've been stratified and if they've been stratified correctly. It is possible that a practice could be asked to provide a copy of a patient's risk stratification certificate, which is something that the risk stratification software will produce. So when you go through both stages of the risk stratification process, it will provide a risk stratification certificate for each patient, which would include that patient's tier level. And the handbook outlines that that is something that should be kept on the clinical record, and it's also possible that it's something that could be uploaded onto someone's My Health record also. I mean, it is. I think that if I was being terribly cautious, it is possible that if the department asked for some information relating to risk stratification of patients and it was found that a practice had been consistently incorrectly stratifying patients, that would be something that we would be wanting to follow up. As Janet said, we've got a very clear focus on education and helping practices to do the right thing in the first instance. However, if there continue to be some challenges in that area, it would be something for consideration for the department in terms of, is it appropriate for the practice to continue in the program? Is there any other avenues of recourse that need to be considered? But certainly our first intention is providing practices with the tool, testing that tool does the right things, and providing you with education and support to use that tool properly. Does that answer your question?
In a sense, so I guess it will be probably related to the first question as well in terms of the related, unrelated fee-for-service items. So would there be, as part of the trial phase, a look at the data and how much fee-for-service, and would that be, I guess, picked up, for example, if, let's say, there seem to be more fee-for-service items compared to what was expected for a patient enrolled in the healthcare home program?
Yeah, so I mean, it's certainly true that one of the data sets that the department will have available to it is the MBS billings of doctors and patients participating in the healthcare home model. And we're really interested in monitoring that, and we'll be doing so closely so that we can, as Janet has said, look at whether or not the bundle payments are at the right value and are covering the majority of care, which is our expectation. But yeah, it's certainly true that from that data set, we would be able to see if there are some outliers, and that would provide the department with an opportunity to follow up with practices that were outliers, and you know, see if there's good reason for that to be the case, to see if there's education that we could provide to help practices to implement the model as intended, and if necessary, to continue down, I guess, that kind of compliance activity option to ensure that the model is being implemented as intended.
Okay, thank you. I know this is... Sorry. There you go.
It's Janet here. I just wanted to add, if we have a system where we've got the bundled payment being used and a significant amount of MBS fee-for-service running alongside of it, then the program hasn't really worked the way we had intended. So that's why we've said that the MBS fee-for-service item should be quite small, because I'm sure, as you'd appreciate, most of the care that the patient would be coming in with who had multiple and complex chronic conditions should be related to or linked to their chronic care. So, and this is related to us needing to validate that tier level is appropriate and can cover the majority of the care. So this is where we will be looking closely at the services that are being provided and making sure that we've got that balance right.
Okay, thank you. Sorry, it's not listed as a question, but related to payment. Could I just ask if the tier payment, will they only be reviewed at the end of the trial, or are there plans to review the tier payments if, let's say, halfway during the trial period, it looks like financially it's not really working out?
So there's a couple of things there. We will be reviewing it along the way. So our evaluation is both formative and summative. So that will give us an opportunity to make any adjustments to the program if we can during the first stage. We want to be as responsive as we can to any issues that might come up. The threshold, the payment threshold won't be changed unless we've really got it significantly wrong, but I think with a lot of the modelling and the testing that we've done with some practices that aren't in stage one, I think we were confident that we had it in the ballpark. But if you found a patient who was particularly complex, and for example they were a tier three patient, you were receiving them a maximum amount of funding, and you felt that they needed additional support, you could remove that patient from the first stage and put them back into the MBS stream. So you're not, so as that's kind of the safety net for you if you've got particularly complex people and they might have an event which changes their health outcome for the long term and you believe that they need a different avenue of support, then you can take them out of the program.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, moving on to payments. So we've got, have payment methodologies been considered or workshopped, and will there be a computer program to simplify the process? So we've been working with the Association of Practice Management on the development of a framework to assist general practices and Aboriginal community controlled health services to use their existing practice management software programs to build internal systems to support the recording and monitoring of healthcare homes activities. So we mentioned this a little bit earlier, and this is to also help us understand the sorts of services that are being provided within the bundled payment as a way to validate the tiers as well. So the framework will provide information on assigning a value to the healthcare home activity and then using that existing practice management system to internally manage or disperse the healthcare home bundle payment. So the framework is being developed for us to be able to understand those services that are being provided, but we think it's got a broader utility for the practices to assist with some of that budgeting and division or assignment of funding. So we're expecting that that framework will be finalised in time for the rollout of the healthcare home training program, which is August, so not too far away. Then there's another question, does the Healthcare Home Funding Assurance Toolkit have a template to keep track of the budget? So no, the toolkit won't include the template. So the work that I've just mentioned is really the way that we see that work rolling out. The toolkit, as we mentioned, is going to provide a range of policies, procedures, systems and day-to-day activities that will help you ensure accurate billing, but it doesn't have a template per se. Any questions on that one? Yeah, I'm just sorry, there was one other one about the payment in arrears. So healthcare home bundle payments are paid to the practice. The practices then need to determine how to manage those funds internally, including how and when doctors are reimbursed for their healthcare home services that they provide to their enrolled patients. So we expect that, you know, practices will probably take different approaches depending on their business models and their models of care. So those will be decisions that the practices need to make. And the last lot of questions were in relation to PHN support, and Deb, they're probably best for me to hand over to you there.
No dramas, thanks, Janet. Okay, so I guess the key factors are that PHN is obviously very willing and happy to be an assistive resource here. This is a Commonwealth Department of Health initiative led by the Department of Health. We have been funded specifically to provide two FTE practice facilitators, and we've recruited those. One of those, someone's got a dreadful cough, awful. One of those starts next week and the other one starts on the 1st of August. So they will be fully on board and oriented by the time the training takes place. Additionally, the department have very kindly supported us to have a digital health officer to assist with the identification and enrolment of patients. So that's another FTE. That's three full-time equivalents that the PHN will have to support our healthcare home practices. In addition to that, we also have four primary healthcare liaison officers that we already have within our PHN team. And obviously this is a key initiative that they'll be assisting with as well. Two of those primary healthcare liaison officers will also be attending the training. So we'll have a team of six in essence and seven in fact in total that will be out there supporting general practices. So we're supporting with the identification and enrolment of patients and also assisting in the training, the dissemination of training, understanding of training to general practice and the setup and facilitation of system support that you might need. I've already talked a little bit about the shared care planning tool. Janet's talked very succinctly around the data and, you know, that's obviously a work in progress in terms of how we, you know, might do that and relies on a good relationship between the PHNs and the general practice. So obviously we'll be very keen to be working with you around all of that. So we're here to assist and we're more than happy to do so.
Excellent. Were there any other questions that people had that were not included in the list we've spoken to?
Vanessa from Riverside Medical. I'm just wondering how whether the handbook is available now. It would appear that, is that something that is freely available at the moment or...?
Hi. Yes, so the handbook and program documentation is available. If you have recently come on board as a replacement practice, that documentation may not have been provided yet, but we can certainly look to get that to you as quickly as possible, even just in terms of it being template documentation rather than needing to wait for the formal offer if that is the case.
No, we were a regional practice, so I haven't received anything. I've had
okay.
conversations with the department, but I haven't received a handbook.
Okay, no problem. I'll leave that with me, and I'll certainly follow up tomorrow and make sure that we get that to you tomorrow.
Thank you.
And I guess just another thing that I'd like to bring to people's attention, there's about 20 practices in the original 200 shortlisted that didn't have the information we needed about their entity details. Alex, did you just want to flag that with people in case there's anyone that's needing to provide some information to us?
Yes, absolutely. So at the moment, we would have an area within the department that is looking to just complete required corporate information with which it can make formal offers. And of course, the program documentation is part of that. So certainly what we're looking to do is to make sure that we can get all the necessary information and get practices on board as quickly as possible. And that will greatly assist in terms of being ready for the training and the support from the PHN. So certainly, I guess, if you have been contacted or in relation to that. Certainly we're hoping that any information that has been requested can be provided as quickly as possible, and this will largely relate to the type of legal entity that the Commonwealth is providing the grant to, then that will certainly assist. But certainly, again, if you have not received a request or a formal offer, we're currently working through ensuring that we've basically got into contact with everybody. But certainly if that hasn't occurred, you know, certainly please let me know, and we can look to facilitate that as quickly as possible.
Okay. Has anyone got any other questions of the department, Janet and Alex, and, oh, I've forgotten who else was online. I'm so sorry.
It's Renee.
Renee, sorry. I've got a list here and I'm going, oh, okay. Any more questions? Because we're doing exceedingly well. It's only 20 past eight. All righty. So everyone has received, I know that our team sent out the questions and the answers that we were able to provide attached to those. So there was some extra stuff there. I think also for Riverside Family Medical Practice, we actually do have a local contact for you. So that local contact was Vanessa. So she was actually sent out the healthcare home handbook again. So we have actually sent that directly, but you know, Alex will follow that up to make sure that you get it as well. But if you need it in a more timely fashion, and there's another email address that we can send it to, if you could just make contact with us tomorrow and let us know, we'd be happy to flick it straight over. As I said at the start, we are putting a button on our website in the next few days. It'll certainly be up by the end of this week, and we will provide links to all of the department's documents that are on their website, so we won't duplicate them, because obviously when they update them, you know, you need to have the most updated information. So we'll have links there that you can click on that will take you to the relevant document, and any of the resources or fact sheets that we've actually put together in terms of what we're doing and what we're pulling together, we will also have that up there. And I think I said at the start, but just for those that might have joined a bit later, in the next couple of weeks, we will be in contact with all of the practices again, looking to set up a face-to-face workshop with all of the relevant principals for those practices that have actually signed their contracts with the department, and getting you together and talking about what your needs might be, and what we've actually got in place already to be able to support you with healthcare homes, which is in essence a new model of care for people with chronic disease. So has anyone got any other questions that they want to ask? Otherwise, we've got an early 7 minutes. No? I'd just like to thank everyone for taking part, and this is being recorded, so you know, we'll put all the questions and answers. Thank you very much to the department, to Renee and Janet and Alex, and I've done it in different order so you don't feel less important. Is that better, Renee? I'll put you first.
That was wonderful. Thank you.
Excellent. All good. Thank you very much. It's been really informative, and stay in touch, people, and we'll get back to you soon, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night.
Bye.